during that time frame, it was some deals that were cut that was rooted in systemic racism. And during that time frame, it was some deals that were cut that was rooted in systemic racism. And Rutherford B. Hayes cut a deal by saying, you know, if you allow me to have the White House, then I will give you the Supreme Court, which will undermine and roll back all the progress that was made up until that first Reconstruction era, which, you know, what folks are saying, we have not really, you know, the times that we're living in today, we have not seen again, which I must say, history have shown us that we are reliving those moments all over again. By that time, again, you know, we had the 1898 riots, 1914, you know, we had Woodrow Wilson, who was elected as president. And then, you know, we get to the time frame of 1916, 100 years ago, roughly a little 102 years ago. You know, not only did we have Wilson elected to the office of the White House, but we also had a president who fully unleashed this white supremacist attack in the Oval Office by playing the Birth of a Nation, just for his own personal privilege. So therefore, we began to see all this progress being rolled back. We were seeing at that time frame, Black men being lynched one per day, which then, you know, launched the NAACP, the birth of the NAACP. And then fast forward, you know, that was the first Reconstruction era had came to an end. The second, and again, when those folks obtained office, the first thing that they, you know, rolled back was voting rights, education, criminal justice, fair tax laws, and finally, I'm so sorry, labor rights. So therefore, you know, we didn't see this other wave of progress until the Civil Rights era. And that is when, again, you know, we began to see, you know, the this wave is like this wave of progress, this, you know, pulling of strings. You know, we make some progress and then it gets rolled back. This finally happened in the 1950s and 1968. And then again, that same wave of progress was also eliminated or killed by another wave of this white lash, which started with the killing of Medgar Evers, the killing of, you know, President Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, Malcolm X. So they began to attack leaders, which also ended the, you know, the second Reconstruction era. So again, this wave of progress, this white lash is nothing new. It's simply history repeating itself. And I think, you know, so again, I think, you know, history is showing us that this struggle is a long-term battle. The struggle for freedom and justice is ongoing. And then again, the last little bit that I'm going to transition over to our next great folks was finally in, you know, 08, when we saw, you know, President Obama, who relaunched this fusion politics when Blacks and whites and old, young, gay, straight, rich and poor joined together to lift up a fusion message. You know, it worked. And then again, we saw another white lash. And immediately after President Obama was elected, we saw, you know, some of the worst voter restriction laws. We saw this claim of voter fraud, which we know is a myth. We know that voter fraud is a myth, but voter suppression is alive. You know, Jim Crow essentially abridged and denied folks the right to vote. However, James Crow Esquire is a fancy guy who wears a suit, who goes behind and plays with computers and dilutes Black and brown and political power. So, you know, I think that we are on the right path. And, you know, it's this beautiful James Baldwin quote that says, you know, I love America more than any other country in this world. And for that reason, I insist to criticize her perpetually. And I think that is what we're going to do tonight. We are saying that we love this country so much that we cannot continue to allow progress to be, you know, eliminated just because folks are afraid of the beautiful faces that are on this screen here. So I'm going to turn this over to I believe it's Rebecca who was next.
Hey, y'all. I'm just going to talk a little bit about voter suppression. And like Tyler and William have already alluded to, there's always a racial component as it relates to voter suppression. There's a reason why in 1898, when Black men and, white people, were beginning to gain political power, there's a reason why there was the huge coup d'etat in North Carolina. There's a reason why in 1913, even as white women were marching for their right to vote, they refused to allow Black women to participate and march at the front of the line with them. We've heard about, the first Reconstruction, we've heard about, the second Reconstruction. And one of the great things that came out of the second Reconstruction was the Voting Rights Act of 1965. For the first time in this country, Black people and Americans as a whole, citizens as a whole, had the protected right to vote. And it was in place for 48 years until the Shelby County versus Holder decision in 2013. In this past election, the 2016 presidential election was actually the first presidential election without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And we see some of the things that have come out of that across the country in the wake of the 2016 presidential election. Over nearly 900 polling sites were closed across the country, mainly in areas that were highly populated by Black citizens. We see how states across the country have passed voter suppression laws. In North Carolina, we had one of the worst laws in the country that inhibited the rights of citizens to vote and to cast their ballots. And one number that stuck out to me from the audit, across the country, 13% of all Black men have been denied the right to vote, mainly because of felon disenfranchisement laws. So we see, laws that, once prohibited, former slaves are now disenfranchising their descendants. These laws have mainly been passed across the South. In four states, Florida, Kentucky, Virginia, and Tennessee, more than 1 in 5 Black adults cannot vote. And this seems like it should be a basic American right, but so many people are denied, the right to vote. Currently, 6 million people across the country are denied the right to vote, which has tripled from 2 million in 1968. So in some ways, we have less voting rights now than we had when the Voting Rights Act was first passed. We're denied political power. We see it's not just Black Americans, but Latinos are highly disenfranchised. Native Americans, are highly targeted and disenfranchised by these laws, poor whites. And it causes us to wonder, why are we being prohibited from exercising, our political power? And I'm gonna keep it short, but I did want to just lift up a quote that I came across in the audit. And it's a quote by Caitlin Swain, who was one of the lead attorneys in the voting rights lawsuit in North Carolina. And she said, the same states that have the most voter suppression efforts also host the greatest denial of healthcare, denial of living wages, the highest rates of incarceration and disproportionate imprisonment of people of color, and the highest rates of child poverty. Affordable housing, disability benefits, medical care, income and living wages, protections against environmental racism, and the divestment of long-term wealth in our communities foundationally depend on the right to a true political voice. We can't talk about, protecting our other rights if so many people are denied the simple right to vote. And we need to be bringing voter suppression into the conversation. So yeah, that's all I have at the moment. And I'm going to turn it over to
Yeah, so I think, thank you for that, Rebecca, and giving us the history of voting rights. I think what we next wanted to turn to was to jump into just a brief understanding of some of the immigration policy. And Zainab was going to help lead us in that aspect. So I wanted to turn it over to her, have her talk to us a little bit about that.
Hey, you guys, I'm Zainab. I'm pretty sure you were on the schedule next, William, but we'll go from it.
Did I mess up? Thank you for helping me.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's what we do as millennials call them out. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how systematic racism plays into immigration. What's going on at the border. Basically, you know, there's a human rights catastrophe occurring on our borders. And basically, it's never really been about keeping America safe. It's never really been about protecting our children. It's never been about upholding the rule of law. It's really always been about race. And federal immigration enforcement is currently explicitly targeting immigrants of color from South America to Africa to South Asia to the Middle East. And like to this point, like teenagers or young people seeking legal asylum are arrested and they're forced into detention centers and really with no path to freedom in sight. You have naturalized citizens hunted down in their communities and deported, and you know, they're children are being shipped into foster care. And we've seen where our country has lost or doesn't know where many of these children that they separated from their families are. Let that sink in, because that's not something that is not what you think of when you live in America, of a country being able to lose children that they separated on their own. Like, that is not normal. And people need to realize that it is not normal, and it is not okay to just be okay with that. You have children who are being torn from their mothers. So the current U.S. administration has basically, they're continuing to escalate racist and anti-immigration policies. Basically they're stripping protections for immigrants brought into this country as children, repeatedly attempting to ban immigration from Muslim countries, which we know now has happened, proposing massive southern border walls, stepping up deportation raids, which we've seen even in our own community here in Raleigh, North Carolina. You've seen ICE raids and people being more likely to be deported. And then we're reducing admission for people who receive refugee status. So the amount of refugees that we're accepting has gone down immensely. And really, these inhumane immigration policies are and always have been rooted really in white supremacy, which is built on the systematic criminalization and dehumanization of Black, Brown, and Indigenous bodies. And it's something that we really need to realize. It's not something that's new. Since about 1968, there's been a steady increase in both federal spending, which is aimed at keeping immigrants out of this country. So we increased federal spending from $2 billion to $17 billion in 2015. Me personally can figure out a lot other ways to use that. Maybe our failing education system or other aspects. Sorry, I didn't know if someone was talking. Oh man, okay. And so also we've seen deportations since 1996, which at the moment we're totaling about 6 million deportations. And you know, these don't just affect people who are being deported or detained. It's also impacting their communities and family members, and which are facing more difficulty in basically affording basic expenses, meeting rent, and paying for utilities. On the other hand of that, if we look at it, meanwhile, child poverty rate, which means about 21% of immigrant children are impoverished. And then also researchers have found that the impact of immigration enforcement disproportionately affects low-income children, which once again leads to greater difficulty in affording those basic expenses. So it's just, you know, once again, all of these, like both systematic racism, it impacts mainly people from lower income communities. And we are continuing to have this war on poverty in a way where we're really impacting Black and Brown communities. So anytime like the border is made as like, you know, the opposite of lawful, it becomes very criminal. So that's what's justified, you know, the building of border fences, border walls, the posting of thousands of agents, and the increased numbers of like weapons and arms at the U.S.-Mexico border. But we've seen over the militarization to the United States, we saw the militarization of police departments in our country. We saw that they learned out of border experiences how to militarize a police department and give them the tools to repress and persecute people in the United States. And we know that we need to take up the decriminalization of immigrants and poor communities, because we really need a democratic process that's accountable to our communities. And none of these are unique to border communities, because once you demilitarize police at the border, they went back into the major community and you see militarized police around the country that once again impact primarily Black and Brown people and specifically African Americans. Systematic racism is just, it just denies our humanity as, it just denies our humanity as a means of denying our freedom and political power. It's a tactic. It's been deployed for centuries, and honestly, we can't let it continue. Just some things from the audit. I think we talked about the spending, but since 2016, the spending has risen to almost 9 times since 1976, and with about 11 times as many deportations. And in 2016, 340,000 immigrants were removed or deported. In 1 year, we removed almost 350,000 immigrants. And it's important to realize the economic impact of that. In California, they're already facing a shortage of workers, specifically on farms and other areas, because immigrants are scared or they're gone and they've gotten deported. And it's just spending a lot of money on and a lot of effort and time on when there are things in this country that we need to fix, such as the immense amount of poverty that we have. And the fact that we as a country can, you know, systematically, I guess, target groups by color is not something that I feel like our country was built on. Well, maybe it was built on it, but it's not the values of what our country is today. It's not something that, you know, I grew up in a time where things right now might be worse than they were after like 9/11. Like, I never ever thought that we would have a president that would implicitly say, oh, you know what, we're going to basically ban all of these Muslim countries. And on top of that, we're calling it a Muslim ban, but it's not really a Muslim ban, but it is. And so it's just hard to hear that coming from a president, and knowing that even though I was born and raised here as an American, that I'm not really looking for a path of how people I'm going to be accepted. And with that type of terminology, it continues to really dehumanize Black and Brown communities. And it plays into a larger system of, you know, racism, that unless we tackle racism or racism as a systematic way, we are not really going to be able to, you know, move forward as a country and really raise the quality of life of all communities, and not just kind of be explicit. So I'm going to turn this over to Matt, and he is going to talk a little bit more about another topic. Oh, about systematic racism and economic opportunity. So thanks, guys.
Deb, Matt, everyone, and I'm going to be talking about economic exclusion and sort of systemic racism and how they've gone hand in hand. There's a lot of ways that racism has been directed at denying economic opportunity for communities of color, and historically, specifically Black communities of color, because that's just like the longest part of our history. But I think I wanted to talk about one major portion of it, just because there's so much to talk about. It's easier to get talk about like tangible things, and one of the major ones is the practice of redlining. And so if y'all out there are super familiar with that, I'm sorry for boring you, but it's really important. And as someone who studies space and urban planning, I think it's incredibly important with the way that our communities are spaced now and how they're laid out. So basically the practice of redlining, it originated about 80 years ago. And this is not to say this is the only discriminatory action that's occurred or that it didn't occur before this, but this is sort of when the official policy began. So 80 years ago, we were in a pretty serious mortgage crisis, and it was around the time of the Great Depression, and people weren't corporations and businesses weren't lending to people to get them homes. So the federal government stepped in and created things like the 30-year mortgage and other ways to get Americans able to buy houses. And a federal agency, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, was tasked with creating residential security maps of major American cities. They did this really throughout the country. I mean, we talk about the major cities, but it happened everywhere. And in these maps, officials would label neighborhoods basically on their risk. And they would outline in red, which is where redlining comes from, areas that were hazardous. And really and truly, these areas were pretty much Black communities. And what happened was that for decades and decades and decades, really until about the late 60s, mortgages and other investment opportunities and other forms of capital weren't injected into these communities. So we basically had tons of investment going to white families to buy houses and build wealth, and buying houses and owning a home is one of the major forms of wealth accumulation in the country. And it was by and large denied to Black families. And I mean, if we think about like the GI Bill post-World War II and a lot of other opportunities like that, they were also denied to Black communities and Black families. And it also extends to other communities of color as well. So I don't mean to just focus on one, but basically that's the gist of redlining. And there's a great report by the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. It's the NCRC for short. And they came up with a report about a couple months ago, I want to say, and they really outline how economic and racial segregation was created by redlining. Not wholly, but redlining had a major impact on it. And that this segregation persists, that the effects of redlining are still there. And that's why you can see serious segregation in cities. And because there was no investment in not just mortgages, but like things like banks and small businesses and other kinds of entities really weren't given the injection of capital that other areas, basically white areas of cities were. And so we see, persistently parts of cities are wealthier and parts of them are pretty poor. And oftentimes the communities of color are poor, and a lot of it stems from this discriminatory practice, and I think it's important to talk about that, because obviously it's crazy that it happened and it's horrible, but it's also recognizing that we can move forward and try to figure out ways to get money back into those neighborhoods and back into those communities, and really put everyone on equal economic footing. And Ta-Nehisi Coates has a really great quote about redlining. And he says that redlining destroyed the possibility of investment wherever Black people lived. And if you think about it like that, then I think it shows what we need to do going forward, which is figure out ways to invest in these communities again, but also do it in an inclusive way. You know, we don't want to do like urban renewal or, you know, gentrify somewhere or something like that, but really trying to figure out a way to get money in, you know, into these communities and to stay in those communities and sort of, you know, help rectify what's been going on. And in terms of what we can do about that, I mean, there's a lot of things, but I think for me, one of the biggest ones is pay attention to local politics. I know with everyone, there's a lot going on. It's tough to pay attention and vote and care about like all these subsets of politics, but local government has a lot of impact and a lot of day-to-day impact on people's lives and where we live. And they, for instance, local governments are really one of the biggest, if not the biggest, driver of affordable housing in the United States. And so finding politicians and leaders that care about that sort of thing and getting them into office, and also just joining, there's all kinds of boards you can join in local governments. And no matter where you live, if it's a big city or a small town, there's a lot of ways you can get involved and a lot of ways you can impact where you live. And that's one of the biggest ways we can talk about, like, you know, investing in places. And then the last thing I just want to say is it's important in planning and in law and a lot of other areas we talk about sort of community-based decision-making. And that's where basically someone like me would come in and say, you know, instead of normally or instead of in past times being like, well, you know, I think you should do this, this, and this. It should be going into communities and saying, you know, what do you need? What do you want? What does your community need? And spend a lot of time there and then basically try to accomplish those goals for them. And that's, you know, gentrification is a complex topic, but that's one of the ways we can sort of get at that. And that's one of the ways that I think it's possible to sort of reverse some of the practices that have happened in redlining through the past. But that's really mostly my spiel. If anyone wants to hop on and talk, feel free. Yeah.
I'm just going to reiterate what you said about joining local government, because I find that extremely powerful, and the fact that just young people in general are just not involved in local government at all. We see more of an involvement on like state and federal levels, even with like, you know, work on people's campaigns or whatnot. But like Matt said, it impacts us daily. And in terms of affordable housing, even police reform, a lot of times counties just schools and which schools. So that could have definitely an impact based off, you know, the racial demographics of schools, the school to prison pipeline, like all of that is kind of local government plays a huge part in that. So I'm just going to reiterate what Matt said and just said, you know, get involved, and there's more than enough things to do. But if you need suggestions, feel free to contact us.
I just want to make a quick point about the way that the racial wealth is tied to homeownership and housing, and then transition into education that way, if that's cool. I wanted to mention the statistic that when it comes to wealth by race, the median white family has $163,000 in wealth, and the median Black family has $17,000 in wealth. That's a huge disparity, and a lot of that is caused since, you know, wealth and real estate tends to be a really good investment, and that tends to affect a lot of public schools are funded via property taxes, and that has affected disparities in terms of public education. Can y'all hear me? So if that's all right, I'm going to transition us into education. And I have three main points I want to make. I'm going to focus on K-12 education, but the audit has a lot of great information about higher education as well. The three main points I want to bring up are, one, segregation did not end with Brown versus Board of Education. And schools are more segregated now than they were in the late 60s. Two, segregation empirically harms underserved students of color, and desegregation empirically does not harm white students. And three, education is a really clear example of the systematic way that past racism is used to justify present and future racism. And I'll talk about a little bit more about that later. But first, I wanted to go into just a quick history of education and segregation in the United States. So in 1954, we got Brown versus Board of Education, which ruled separate but equal unconstitutional because it is inherently unequal. And then it wasn't until 1971 that we got Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg, which mandated busing through this notion that ruling segregation illegal isn't enough. We need to actively integrate our schools. So that happened in 1971, and desegregation actually empirically did help close the achievement gap through the 70s, between Black and white students. But it began to stall through this period of white flight and resegregation via housing. So all of these issues are really interlinked. And then through Nixon's presidency and his Southern strategy, we saw even more resegregation because that Southern strategy was meant to placate white Southerners who were scared by integration. Then over the decades, segregation began to take really more pernicious forms, like classroom segregation, where you saw, you know, perhaps low-income and high-income or Black and white students in the same schools, but in different classes. And you see discrimination in those classrooms as well. So a statistic that I found really powerful that's in the audit is that Black girls current day are 6 times more likely than white girls to receive suspensions. And now we see that the nation's schools are more segregated than they were in the late 60s. I know I said that already, but that's mind-boggling to me. And now in the last 15 years, we've kind of pulled the wool over our eyes, and hundreds of school districts have been released from their mandates to desegregate their schools because Brown versus Board of Education was, you know, over 50 years ago. There's this notion that we've done our due diligence with desegregation, which is not the case. And now we're opening up the debate for school choice. So I wanted to talk for a second about school choice using Charlotte, North Carolina as a case study. The North Carolina Board of Education just allowed 4 new charter schools in Charlotte suburbs, which is leading to an enrollment decline in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system for the first time in its history. And the main issue here is that public schools obviously have to accept all children that fall under their purviews, but charter schools don't have to do that. So the public schools with the lower enrollment end up underfunded, and they also end up with children who have more needs. And this just makes the disparities grow even more. And I really just think this is why history is important. Instead of just thinking about ahistorical models and market theory, because all of these issues are tied to a very clear history of racist practices with mortgage lending, with highway construction, with gentrified development, all of which Matt brought up. And so when we think about school choice, we need to think about choice for whom. And the answer tends to be the wealthy, white, and suburban part of America. And just another important statistic, from 2000 to 2014, K through 12 schools, public schools, where 75 to 100% of the students were Black or Hispanic and eligible for free or reduced price lunch, increased from 9 to 16%. So we are resegregating in our schools as a result of this new type of white flight, or as Tyler said, white lash, that is falling under this branding of school choice. And just to zoom out, as I close up my time and think about what this means for America, work from Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's this reporter I'm completely enamored with, has shown that white families want neighborhood schools when the neighborhoods are white and affluent, but they want school choice when the neighborhoods are brown and black. And this is really a way that past racism is used as a justification for present and future racism. Because in this discussion that we have about how parents just want good schools or safe schools and high achieving schools, they're really dog whistling and blaming a systematic racialized poverty on cultural deficiencies on students that they call thugs and use dog whistles like that when those are just students just like their own kids. So when we think about what we can do moving forward, I think we need to recognize that true equality means that if a school isn't good enough for your kid, it's not good enough for anyone's kid. And we need to recognize that just because an issue is systemic, that doesn't mean that our individual choices don't matter. And just to kind of echo something that Matt said, when we think about our own roles as millennials, a lot of us lived through an end of active desegregation in our school system. I know that I did. I went to Wake County Public Schools in North Carolina, and in 2010 and 2011, they ended their program through which they had a maximum of students in each school that were eligible for free and reduced price lunch. So they found a way to integrate students through socioeconomic status. They ended that practice, and now schools are really segregated by socioeconomic status. And so a way to combat that, as Matt said, is to get involved with local politics and really pay attention to what local school boards are doing. Because the way schools work is all through property taxes and really local politics. And that's the place that we make that change. And if anyone wants to jump in and talk about either their own experiences with education or any patterns that they've noticed, totally feel free.
I just wanted to hop in. I'm not going to talk about education, but I did want to piggyback on something that Anita talked about, which was getting involved locally and something I mentioned earlier. And I don't think expounded on enough earlier, but I think that in terms of how local elections are tied to economic development for Black and Brown folks, a lot of it is basically, it's tied in terms of you need to pay attention to candidates that are saying like, we need affordable housing in these communities, or we need inclusive economic growth, because it doesn't really do much good if you attract a bunch of businesses to a town and or a city or, you know, wherever you live, and basically it only benefits a certain subset or, you know, a white subset. I think local elections really matter in terms of getting people there from communities that are affected, and getting them into power so that they can recognize like, okay, you know, we need this type of investment here. We need to invest in maybe the local businesses of, you know, like Black businesses or brown businesses that are already in existence and get capital into those, or attract the kinds of development that are friendly, you know, like perhaps to that are walkable, or, you know, I think it just matters in terms of paying attention to what leaders and what candidates are saying about economic development. Because like I said, it doesn't really do much good if you bring in Amazon or something like that, but, you know, it's 30 minutes outside of the town and only, you know, a certain amount of people can afford to drive there or apply there or whatever it is. So I think it's just important to make sure that people recognize that the inclusive aspect of it. And so that's all I've got. And it's sort of a messy answer, but yeah.
Thank you, Matt. So I'm Sunny, and I'm gonna talk about the school to prison pipeline, which is something that Anita alluded to already. And Zainab talked about it in terms of what you can do, how you can affect local policy and local governments and what's actually happening in your community. So the school to prison pipeline is kind of a intersection between our criminal injustice system, as we like to call it, and our education system in this country. And it refers to this really disturbing trend of criminalizing Black and Brown youth, LGBTQ youth, and youth with disabilities in schools, pushing them out to actually be more likely to be on a path towards prison than towards a good life. Something that is key to racism, to systemic racism, as Will talked about earlier in his chronology of the creation of race in this country, but also something that he'll talk about after me, is that criminalization and making something, someone, a group of people illegal or hated is one of the key tactics to really convincing a society that people deserve to not be treated like first-class citizens. And so the school-to-prison pipeline is incredibly disturbing because this is happening to children. This is something that teachers and school administrators are enacting to make criminals out of kids. So Anita referred to this, but in the Poor People's Campaign audit, they cite that Black girls specifically are 6 times more likely than white girls to receive suspension. 6 times is 600% more likely. Just like that, Black youth generally are 500% more likely, and Latinx youth are 65% more likely to be detained or committed than their white counterparts. And these are all youths. And this is really coming from school systems, from student resource officers or SROs, the police officers that are in public schools. It's interesting, it's not interesting, it's disgusting that actually when a school is more, just like what we just heard Anita talking about, a school systems being segregated and then schools being entirely Black or Brown or majority white, you can really predict how students will be treated based on what type of school they go to. For example, a survey or a report collected by a law professor from the University of Florida College of Law says that in schools where students of color accounted for more than half of the student body, the probability of the school using a mix of metal detectors, school police and security guards, locked gates and random sweeps was 2 to 18 times greater than at schools where the non-white population was less than 20%. So just that statistic there shows you that when Black or Brown students are the majority, schools are being treated like prisons. They're being built like prisons and not like schools, while the white schools are not as likely to experience this type of treatment. And in North Carolina, for example, did you want to say something, Anita?
Can I jump in just for a second?
Yeah.
Say that one of, like, what you just said is really important, because one of the really insidious ways that we deny the necessary social and economic changes are by saying that these differences are a result of culture instead of economics and race. So we tend to say things like, oh, Black youth are just disinterested in school because to be interested in school is to act white, and that's seen as uncool. And President Barack Obama even made that argument one time. So it's really insidious and deep-rooted, and it's important to call out the way that that's not actually the case. And empirically, you can see that the resources that these kids are getting are really different. Yeah.
Thank you for saying that and reminding me to say that all of these statistics are based on the same infraction. So if a Black student is suspended 500% or is more 500% more likely to be suspended than a white student, it is at the same infraction. So if they do the exact same thing, the Black student is 500% times more likely to be suspended. So that's something that, like, I think is just such a scary statistic, but like it really shows you how deep this is. This is not a difference of acting. It's not a difference of culture. It's not a difference of behavior. It's a difference between racist treatment and not racist treatment. So lastly, I just wanted to say that in North Carolina, this trend is deeply disturbing all across the country, but in North Carolina, because most of us are in North Carolina right now, I just wanted to give the statistic that Black students make up almost 26% of the student population in public schools in North Carolina, but received 56.7% of the short-term suspensions. So that's double the amount of students that actually are in the, or of Black students that are in the student population. So that just gives you a quick image of what the school to prison pipeline looks like. And Will and Tyler will talk about what being involved or forced into the criminal justice system does and how it impacts people's lives. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Sunny. And just wanted to reiterate one of the most critical aspects before we get into the criminal justice component of this conversation is that when we talk about systemic racism and we talk about how it manifests, what you mentioned is the perception is one of the things that is most critical when we understand how the legacy of how this history still impacts us today. You know, beyond the fact that there are actually concrete systems in place which play out along racial lines, what is more sinister or what is equally as sinister is the accompanying narrative, the accompanying perception that, oh, well, people of color just commit more crimes. People of color are just disinterested in school. And that is rooted in the very, you know, narratives that we talked about in that original chronology, is that, you know, you create perception that people deserve this, that people are inferior, that there are inherent categorizations and that you can make based on race. And it allows people the mindset by which to engage in such a oppressive system. But jumping into criminal justice, you know, quickly, and Tyler's gonna chime in with me, you think first about the legacy of the war on drugs and broken glass police policies, you know, tough on crime politics, which has actually led to increased policing of poor communities and communities of color. That's resulted in a tenfold increase in annual federal discretionary spending since 1976. You look at the United States, which is, you know, not the largest population in the world, but does have the largest prison population in the world. And you looked at, you know, sentenced inmates of all races grew from around 187,000 in 1968 to over 1 million, nearly 1.5 million in 2016, an increase of over nearly tenfold in less than 60 years. People of color account for 66% of the people in prison, although they only make up 39% of the total population. And the number of citizens disenfranchised due to felony convictions has tripled since 1968, from 2 million in 1968 to 6.1 million in 2016. So that has a direct result when we talk about systemic racism and voter disenfranchisement. These issues, they intersect and they play upon one another. And we have to understand them both in their individuality, but also in their collective nature. Because if we're really gonna have a conversation about addressing systemic racism, we can't just have a partial conversation. We have to understand how it affects us all across the spectrum and be able to come up with a not a simple solution, but an efficient solution. With that, I wanna see if my brother Tyler has anything to add.
Right. Thank you, Will, for setting the tone for us. I just have two quick points, and it might be Reverend Barber math, which means two might mean two or three. But I just want to lift up the point that realizing that the war on drugs, or this law and order phrase that we're hearing across the political spectrum, is code words. And this started with Nixon. However, Nixon's administration, you know, began to really create programs to help, you know, address the war on drugs. However, when we look into the 80s, when Mr. Reagan took office, we realized that that's when these issues became more politicized. There we go. I'm gonna get it right in a second. And in order to get elected into office, you had to be tough on crime, and that was a code word. And you know, the criminal justice system, yes, is definitely not made for people of color, especially poor people of color. And I think we have a duty, we have a moral obligation to speak out and to address these issues and really make sure that, you know, this nation is quick to speak out on, you know, white supremacy when it comes to violence, but yet we are silent when we see white supremacy that comes into policies. And, you know, that is what we're seeing in this criminal justice system. And I just want to also lift up the fact that, you know, it's a quote that says, the more things change, the more things remain the same. And that is definitely, you know, lifted up in this criminal justice system that we have. Yet we saw that, you know, my ancestors, my great grandparents couldn't vote because they were, you know, they were slaves. We see the Jim Crow, you know, came and said, if your grandfather was a slave, you couldn't vote. And then we see that if, you know, fast forward into the 21st century, we're seeing that if you're labeled as a felon, your rights are, you know, are gone. You do not have a voice in the system that has that is criminalizing you. And, you know, we're seeing that, and this is how it, and it ties into to housing and to, you know, healthcare and all these other reforms that we need, or these other systems or that come together. And we see that, you know, that if you're labeled as a felon, you are also sent out to a society that does not care about you because, you know, we are supposed to, you know, the criminal justice system is supposed to reform you. However, that doesn't happen when people of color and poor folks are being, they're being seen as profit in the criminal justice system. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. And I am most definitely confident that we are the ones that this nation is looking for. We are the generation that I hope will be able to change this, because it's a great quote by my dear friend and great uncle in my head, John Lewis, who said, if it's not us, then who? If not now, then when? So we are the ones that can change this. And I think that, you know, the great thing about this audit, it brings forth this injustice. And I think that we have, all politics is local, and it starts, you know, you can't fight for fair criminal justice reform if you're not fighting for equal access to the booth. And, you know, your vote, when you skip an election, you're also, you know, eliminating your voice to pick who is your next sheriff, who is your next chief of police, who is your next, you know, county commissioner, who is going to really introduce and try to reform the criminal justice system. So I think, you know, the moral of the story is that every election is important. And we just can't wait until we see a national election to try to jump into this and try to make our voices heard, which is needed. Let me rephrase that, which is needed. I don't want to contradict myself, but we have got to start at the local level and understanding that, you know, I think Will has, you know, lifted up the quote by Thurgood Marshall, said the criminal justice was not necessarily meant for us, but we're going to damn near fight to make sure that it includes all of us. So I'm just going to relinquish the portion of my time for this for someone else to jump in who has something that they can input on the criminal justice system.
Yeah, thank you for that, Tyler. And I think that's a good segue. I think having this understanding, you know, hopefully what we wanted to do with tonight is just have an ongoing conversation. You know, this notion of this concept of systemic racism is too much to try and cover exhaustively in an hour. But we just wanted to, you know, be able to start a conversation, and we hope you all plug into the conversation, this continued conversation that we're going to be having about how we can address it and do our part to address it in our lifetimes. Along those lines, I do want to kick it over to Sunny and Matt, who want to talk a little bit about what solidarity can look like for white people, you know, when we talk about addressing systemic racism.
Hi. Thank you for that, Will. I first want to bring in a quote by Lila Watson, who's an Indigenous Murray activist in what is now Australia. But she says, if you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And I think that's something that we say in this cohort between all of us. It's a quote about solidarity. And it's about recognizing that none of us are free until all of us are free. And I think that that is the crisis that is facing white people in the United States today, is that we believe that we are free. A lot of, and we are not. And I think in the face of understanding all of this racist violence, a lot of the violence that we talked about on this Zoom call today, is that if we are living in a society, in a culture, in a community where we feel that we are living well, that we are free, and we are still seeing that all of this violence is being enacted on Black and Brown people, then there is something deeply wrong with our community and with our culture of whiteness. And so that just brings me to say that for me is how I recognize where I'm coming from in this movement is seeing that I'm not doing it because I think that I can help anyone. I'm not doing it because I think that I'm coming from a more freed place. I think that I know that as long as people that look like me are enacting violence and that I'm complicit in systems that enact violence, then I am not free. And so with that in mind, Matt and I talked about ways that we think that white people can show up in different spaces. I think the main thing that I want to push forward is that white people have a responsibility to do this, because we are the ones that are enacting the violence. And two, that we have a responsibility to keep showing up and keep taking risks, even though it scares us to be uncomfortable. I think that's something that is that's really hard for a lot of white people, including myself. It's really hard to put yourself in uncomfortable situations with your white friends, your family members. But it ends, if you don't take those risks, then you are being complicit in violence. If anyone else would like to add on to that, I do want to also mention that going back to the narrative of race in this country that Will talked about at the beginning of this call, is that racism and anti-Blackness was intentionally created to separate us and to not allow us to create allyship and movements that could overthrow the rich white people, rich white men specifically. So in fusion movements, we are actually invalidating a lot of the lie of race, because really race is also a construction. So racism is very real, but it was constructed to make sure that we would not gain power as people. So our fusion movement is about white people realizing this and waking up our fusion movement is about that for white people in a lot of ways, and to transcend what we know of as racism, and instead fight beyond it together. Thank you. And I think Matt might want to have a couple things to say.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I just I did want to say that I think a big role for white people, or you know, especially coming from someone who's getting in graduate school, I think a key part is just listening. I think, you know, like a ton of policies that were enacted that, you know, tried to help, but they made things worse. I mean, if you're talking like urban renewal and a lot of economic development that's resulted in gentrification and stuff like that. And so I think a big part of our role is to just sort of listen. And, you know, if you're an urban planner, they talk about this. If you're a lawyer, they talk about this. I'm sure there's many other disciplines that talk about it, but in terms of community engagement and going into a community and really sort of serving to listen to them and see what you can do to help them, not necessarily like say, this is what you should do and be paternalistic about it. And I, you know, I sort of see that as a key component, is just sort of taking a step back and listening and then doing what you can, where you can. And I think that's sort of all I got to say on that.
Well, with that being said, we can draw this to a close, but we want to make sure we thank everybody that's on the panel for being a part of this discussion, this dialogue. We thank everyone who is on Zoom. We thank everyone who's on Facebook Live. We are continuing this series where it started out with systemic racism. But I want to point to July 31st at 7 p.m. We will have our next town hall. And the discussion as today was systemic racism, it will be ecological devastation. With that being said, I want to hand the mic on over to Zainab and have her close us out.
Yep, and just like Dr. Ruth mentioned, so July 31st is our next town hall and we'll be discussing ecological devastation. So definitely tune into that. And I ask that you ask at least one other friend to join in with you and bring them to this conversation and let them watch as well. And that'll be at 7 p.m. Eastern time. Some other next steps, if you check both this Zoom call as well as on Facebook Live, you'll see a Google form. And we're calling for anyone who wants to start organizing and leading these discussions and events in their own state or own community to go ahead and sign up on this Google form, and we'll email you with next steps. If you want to get involved, because we need everyone and anyone possible to get involved and really make this a national movement. And we really need young people to join into this movement and be at the forefront of it. Lastly, you should follow us on all social media, because that is the best way to continuously see us in your feed. So on Facebook, it's A New PPC. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and then if you go to the website for People's Campaign, you can sign up your email and receive updates from the Poor People's Campaign, just maybe about events or on the issues. So definitely sign up to that, and we will see y'all on July 31st, and we're looking forward to having this discussion with you guys and continue to moving forward and just continuing this conversation. So have a great night, y'all, and thanks for joining.